welcome to tonight's program on, that's right, the Mike Malloy program. Thanks for tuning in. A couple of people passed away, died. I don't know why we use that term, passed away. A couple of people died here in the last 48 hours that I need to mention tonight. The first is the woman who was Norma Rae in the movie by that title. I had kind of a connection to her in that what I don't know a lot of people know, but the story of Norma Rae, her name was Crystal Lee Sutton. And when she was written about, it was Crystal Lee Jordan. But she was written about by a New York Times reporter back in 1975, I think. The reporter's name was Hank Leiferman. He wrote a piece about her in New York Times Sunday Magazine. And the reason I mention that, I've known Hank for 30 years, and I met him on my 40th birthday, and he said, you know, people introduced me to him. And, yeah, I was impressed. I'd seen the movie. And, he said, yeah, I wrote it for New York Times Sunday Magazine. And, told me the story pretty much, true to form as to what really happened. And Hank and I, interestingly shared exactly the same birthday. Same day, month, and year. Kathy says, really? Yeah, I thought I told you that. No? Yeah. Exact same birthday. So when I saw this a couple of days ago in that she had passed, I haven't seen Hank in, 10, 12 years. He's from South Carolina, too, which is where... the story occurred in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, at a textile plant. I can remember when I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, in 1970, the second time in 1970. I lived there in 1967 and again in 1970. And I used to go to the small towns where J.P. Stevens, Textile Mills, and some of the big mills were the only industry in town. And a lot of people had, it wasn't called black lung, but the people who worked in these plants developed lung conditions from breathing this lint all day. And of course, the companies didn't provide them with breathing apparatus or anything. And the pay was very, very low. I can remember talking with people in Roanoke Rapids, in Wilson, in Rocky Mount, all these different small North Carolina towns, where both the husband and the wife worked. And... Some of them lived in company houses. You know, in the mid-70s, it was still very common in the South. Maybe it was up north, too. But nobody was unionized. And Crystal Lee Sutton was one of the first people who, first women who made an attempt. She was the first woman to make an attempt to say, enough, we're not putting up with this anymore. And, of course, as years went by, what happened to the textile industry in the South as it moved to China? They showed those workers in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama. They showed them, didn't they? And they said, you're going to unionize. Well, you sons of bitches, we'll move out of the country. But anyway, Hank wrote about her in 1975. And I didn't meet Hank until about 6, 7 years later. But Crystal Lee, according to her obituary, she was 17 when she began working at J.P. Stevens, where low pay and poor conditions were the norm, as it was in most of these industries in the South. And years later, when she was 30, she worked there for 16 years. And in 1973, she was a 33-year-old mother of three who earned $2.65 an hour folding towels that had just been manufactured at this plant in northeastern North Carolina. And that was a year a former coal miner from West Virginia, a guy named Eli Zivkovich, arrived in Roanoke Rapids and began trying to organize the plant's workers. And Crystal Lee Sutton became Zivkovich's hardest-working volunteer. She spent hours going door-to-door and coming into work early to try to convince co-workers to form a union. At one point, she was fired when Crystal Lee Sutton copied a flyer that was put out by the mill owners saying that if the plant was unionized, it'd be black people that would run the union. Yeah, that's right. And she was arrested. She then wrote the word union on a piece of cardboard, and as the police were coming to get her, stood up on a workstation in the middle of one of the factory rooms. You probably saw that sign or that scene in the movie. Sally Field, who played the part of Crystal Lee Sutton, remember that scene where she stood up there and held up the sign that said union? The plant's workers joined Miss Sutton's protest and shut down their machines, but they could only do it for about several minutes. And that was the first time a woman took a stand like that in the textile industry in the South, a very strong stand for union. The workers eventually voted for the union, but J.P. Stevens officials didn't sign a contract until 10 years later, and finally most of the textile industry moved out of the country. In 2008, Crystal Lee Sutton said, quote, I call my career, she developed cancer, that's what killed her, cancer. I call my cancer a journey, and it is interesting to see where it goes. It reminds you to live each day to the best you can. You are so much more appreciative of tiny things, end quote. The Motion Picture Editors Guild established the Crystal Lee Sutton Awards, which recognize individuals and organizations whose efforts have contributed to presenting positive images of working people to the American public. So, Crystal Lee Jordan, Crystal Lee Sutton, died at the hospice home of Burlington, North Carolina. She was 68 years old. Ouch. I remember Hank, telling me he didn't write any of the screenplay, or he just wrote the article for New York Times Sunday Magazine. It's one of those long pieces, long form pieces that you find in the Sunday Magazine, the Times, usually every week. And I always thought Hank was a good writer. Like I say, I don't know where he is. Lost track of him about 10 years ago. But that was my connection to Crystal Lee Jordan. As tenuous as it was, when I saw that, I said, oh, man, yeah, I remember. Jody Powell, who I also met way, way back. Jody Powell, who was Jimmy Carter's press secretary and aide, keeled over with a heart attack yesterday at his home on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He was 65. He, according to reports, according to New York Times, he collapsed outside his home, and efforts to revive him in a hospital didn't work. The person who notified the Times was, interestingly, Jack Nelson, who was a reporter. Well, actually, he was a Washington bureau chief for the L.A. Times 30 years ago, who used to just raise hell with Jody Powell about some of Jimmy Carter's positions. And of course, after Powell retired, Jack Nelson and Jody Powell became best of friends. He was more than press secretary, though, Jody Powell. He was a real hellraiser. I met him here. I worked on the Peanut Brigade, which was the reelection campaign in 1979, trying to get Carter reelected. And I did a lot of telephone soliciting, calling people up to get them to vote for Carter again. And Jody Powell, one thing I remember about Jody Powell and the other aide, Hamilton Jordan, who also just died, these two guys were the Southern Mafia. They were the core of the Southern Mafia that kind of ran the Carter administration. Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell, they were both very well educated, although Jody got thrown out of the Air Force Academy for cheating. They were both very well educated. They defied the image of the white Southern male. I mean, just absolutely defied it. Jody Powell was a South Georgia boy, just like Jimmy Carter was. And just a little bit more I want to say about Jody Powell when we come back. Stay with us. I cannot do that. You do what's right by your heart and soul. It's the
is your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Thanks for your indulgence here. It's just that Jody Powell was somebody I knew. Not, I don't mean like somebody to go have beers with, but I got to know him before Jimmy Carter, actually before he became president, back in 76. In 74 and 75, I had been gone from Atlanta for about a year and came back. And like I've said before on this program, Atlanta's a pretty small town. It certainly was 40 years ago, 35 years ago. And the political circles are very small. There was an effort being made, a strong effort being made in the early 70s and mid 70s, kind of the remaining effort by responsible white males and responsible black males, and females, but mostly men at the time, to try not to allow Atlanta to erupt into the kind of racial violence that was occurring all over the South and had occurred in the South. And there was a coalition of politically active blacks and whites that were just damn determined to make sure that Atlanta became what it became. And, you know, a lot of people live here now think it's way too big, 5 million people, yada, yada, yada. But Atlanta survived all that. We had the bombing of the temple here. We had we've had racial violence. We've had religious violence. But for the most part, people like Jody Powell, John Lewis, Jimmy Carter, Hamilton Jordan, people like that, blacks and whites, were determined that it wasn't going to happen here. And not just for the sake of business or commerce, but because they respected each other. Because they realized that in the South, the Jim Crow, the apartheid, the slavery, it had to go. It had to be removed. That's one of the reasons I get so freaked out when I realize what these anti-Obama rallies are all about. Because it's that nasty ass old Southern white thing. And it is. And I don't care what anybody says. I got a couple of emails the other night. I said, well, you're just pushing that too hard. What do you mean it was a Klan rally in D.C. on the 12th? That's damn exactly what it was. A Klan rally without the sheets. But I digress. Jody Powell, was one of those white Southern boys at the time. I don't mean he was a teenager, but, everybody used that term back then. He was an ass kicker too. He was as press secretary, Jody Powell was very polite. He never BS'd. He would tell you he wasn't going to answer the question. He wouldn't stand up and say, well, blah, 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 blah. He would just say, I'm not going to answer that. And if he did answer a question, you could take it to the bank. When Carter unseated Ford in the 76 election, it was just assumed that Jody Powell would be press secretary, and he was. It was one of the Carter's first announcements. Jody Powell was always fiercely loyal. You would not see him leave and do a tell-all book on President Carter. Of course, there was nothing to tell all. Jimmy Carter was what he appeared to be. There was no deception there. Take or leave it. But Jody Powell was quick-tempered. And like I say, he was a hellraiser. His principal role, according to New York Times, his principal role in life was defender of Jimmy Carter. He stayed in character when he wrote The Other Side of the Story, which came out in 1984. Powell accused many journalists of looking down their noses at Carter and his fellow Georgians. Powell had honed his style years before when Jimmy Carter was governor, responding to a critic who accused his boss of communistic tactics against opponents of the busing used to desegregate schools. Mr. Powell wrote that one of the governor's burdens was having to read, quote, barely legible letters from morons, end quote. And he added, quote, I respectfully suggest that you take two running jumps and go straight to hell. End quote. That was Jody Powell. He was a good man. And when I heard about his death, I got an email from a friend here in the Atlanta area. Said, listen, mention it tonight, will you? Another white Southern male liberal who sent me the email. Said, mention it tonight, will you, in some context. I said, yeah, you bet I will, Chuck. So there you go. And, of course, Patrick Swayze, got to mention it. He was a, again from the New York Times, Betsy Sharkey, who's a film critic. She refers to him as Patrick Swayze, the image of dignity, decency, and defiance. And it was. He brought his final challenge, the Times says, as he fought the pancreatic cancer that killed him at 57 years old. Swayze told Guy Adams in Britain's Independent in January after he'd gone through a difficult round of chemotherapy. Swayze said, quote, yeah, I'm angry. Yeah, I'm scared. As if to say otherwise would be insane. So, just wanted to mention that. Thanks for your indulgence. I usually don't, I try not to do obituaries on this program, but just felt that it was appropriate tonight. We'll be back after the break, and I promise things will lighten up. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird.
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more Mike Malloy.
It's 25 before the hour. Jimmy Carter was on NBC's Nightly News tonight with Brian Wilson. And he called out the racists that are attacking Barack Obama. He said he believes race is at the core of much of the opposition to Obama. This is what he said, quote, I think an overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity towards President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he's a black man, that he's African-American. Carter added, quote, I live in the South, and I've seen the South come a long way, and I've seen the rest of the country that shared the South's attitude toward minority groups at that time, particularly African-Americans. He went on to say, quote, and that racism inclination still exists, and I think it's bubbled up to the surface because of the belief among many white people, not just in the South, but around the country, that African-Americans are not qualified to lead this great country. It's an abominable circumstance, and it gives me, and it grieves me, and concerns me very deeply. He added, he predicted, that Obama will be able to, Carter's words, quote, triumph over the racist attitude that is the basis for the negative environment that we see so vividly demonstrated in public affairs in recent days, end quote. So, and thanks to Kathy for sending that to me. Kathy in Green Bay. Yeah, if you are awake and alert and dedicated to the idea of justice, you know, nobody has to talk about equality. Just talk about justice. If you're dedicated to the proposition of justice in this country, equal justice under the law, I guess that would be equality, wouldn't it? But if you're dedicated to the proposition of equal justice under the law, then you have to agree with those few, relatively speaking, Southern white males, and eventually Southern white females, but we're talking about a different era. Not that long ago, but a different era. Southern white males who refused to go along with the prevailing attitudes in the South. And Jimmy Carter certainly is one of those. So was Hamilton Jordan. So was Jody Powell. And a bunch of these Georgia Mafia, they used to call them, that ran the Carter administration. So. But I'm glad to see Carter. You know, Carter tells it like it is, and that's one of the reasons the right wing hated his ass so much. He told the truth. He continues to tell the truth. When he talks about an apartheid system in the occupied territories in Israel, he's absolutely on target. And the degree to which he is on target is measured by the ferocity of the attack by organizations like AIPAC against him when the book came out. When Carter talks about white people who are racist, who are going after Jimmy Carter because of the fact that he's a black man, Carter's absolutely right on. Kathy's blog today at MikeMalloy.com, she quotes Matt Taibbi. Kathy writes about three times a week. I should be doing it the other couple days, but I've just been lazy as hell lately. But she quotes Matt Taibbi. Here's the quote. "It's amazing, literally amazing to me, that it wasn't until Obama pushed through a package containing a massive public works package and significant homeowner aid that then conservatives took to the streets. In other words, it wasn't until taxes turned into construction jobs and mortgage relief that working and middle-class Americans decided to protest. I didn't see anyone on the street when we forked over billions of dollars to help J.P. Morgan Chase buy Bear Stearns. I didn't see anyone on the street when Hank Paulson forked over $45 billion to help Bank of America buy Merrill Lynch, a company run at the time by one of the world's biggest a-holes, John Thane. Moreover, I didn't see any street protests when the government agreed to soak up hundreds of billions in so-called troubled assets from Citigroup, a company that just months later would lend out a jet furnished with pillows upholstered with Hermes scarves to former Chief Sandy Weill so he could vacation in Mexico over Christmas." Yeah, where was this psychopathic suicider Glenn Beck? Where was this large drug addict Rush Limbaugh? Where was this Bunny Ranch visitor Sean Hannity when all that was going on? Well, they were nowhere, and why? For a very simple reason, as we've said on this program many times. The function, the purpose, the raison d'etre of these thugs is to protect corporate America, to keep the proles scrabbling and fighting and arguing and bitching and complaining to each other about, he's going to force us to have health care. Let's go teabag. Here's his birth certificate from Kenya. I mean, that kind of horse crap. That's what these guys are paid millions and millions and billions of dollars to do. And they will always find an audience. This country is chock-a-block with bohunk morons more so than probably any other industrialized so-called democracy on earth. Man, do we have them here, right? So, interestingly, isn't it? I mean, do you find it interesting? I sure do. That these dumbasses don't get riled up until their radio talk show gurus demand it of them and tell them to take to the streets to protest jobs, protest restructuring health care, protest an attempt to bring the troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan. In other words, protest against things that actually work in your best interest. These are dumbass people. I hate to share the same continent with them, much less the same society. Right-wingers are just abysmally devoid of any kind of brain power whatsoever. I don't know, man. It's just awful to see. Speaking of that, Newt Gingrich is in the news. He's got this organization called Newt Gingrich's American Solutions for Winning the Future. and the acronym ASWF, it sounds a bit like ASWIF to me, but it's called American Solutions for Winning the Future. And he gives out awards. He gives an Entrepreneur of the Year award. And this is his fundraising vehicle. You know, Newt is a cheesy-ass, cheap-ass, serial adulter hustler. That's all he is. He's just a cheese ball. But he gives this thing called the Entrepreneur of the Year Award. And this year, it goes to a group, an organization, or a company called Pink Visual. And to the owner of Pink Visual, a woman named Allison Vivas. And the letter that goes with the award, Think Progress and PamsHouseBlend.com. I think PamsHouseBlend.com got a hold of it first and sent it over to Think Progress. But it says, in part, quote, Newt would like to arrange a private dinner with you at the historic Capitol Hill Club on the evening of October 7, 2009 in Washington. You'll dine privately with Newt at his executive venue, and he'll take the occasion to present you with your well-deserved award and have your photo taken together. This tremendous honor. Jesus Christ. These people have no loss of, small egos, do they? This tremendous honor is a testament to your success in building your business and recognition of the risks you take to create jobs and stimulate the economy. As an award winner, you'll be on the ground floor as Newt and his council begin the work to turn this country around. Yada, yada, yada. The only problem here, Pink Visual is a pornography DVD superstore. That's their only business. They sell appliances, you know, sexual appliances, sexual stuff, thingies, and DVDs, porn DVDs. It's not exactly the type of company you expect Newt Gingrich would want stimulating the economy. Now, how does ASWIF, that would be American Solutions for Winning the Future, Gingrich's organization, we'll refer to it as ASWIF. How does ASWIF respond when they got a letter from Think Progress or an email that says, hey, what's up with this? Well, the way they responded was that they said they had inadvertently sent the facts to Allison Vivas and was retracting the honor. Yeah, it was a mistake. An accidental fax addressed to someone at the correct fax number. And it was a fax, not an email, for obvious reasons. I think Newt was just trying to set up a date for October the 7th, 2009 in Washington. And he says you'll dine privately with Newt at this exclusive venue. And he'll take the occasion to present you with your well-deserved award. Inadvertently, huh? Okay. Of course, congratulating a porn company for, you know, stimulating the economy would seem to contradict Newt's highly touted contract with the American family. Remember that? On May 17th, 1995, Gingrich led a press conference on Capitol Hill announcing the Christian Coalition's 10-point contract with the American family. This is different from Newt's 1994 gig Contract with America. One of the items on the Christian Coalition's contract with the American family was restricting pornography. Matter of fact, at the time, Gingrich says, we are committed to, implementing the contract with the family, scheduling hearings on porn, and bringing it all to an end. Right. When it's up that close, make it rain, I'm making it snow. Work the pole, I got the bankroll. I'ma say that I prefer them no clothes. I'm into that, I love women exposed. She threw it back at me, I gave her more. Cash ain't a problem, I know where it goes. She had them
up America one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. So you've got these arbiters of what the Republicans, the conservatives are supposed to do. You have Rush Limbaugh, who takes his little tubes of Viagra and goes to the Dominican Republic, ostensibly, one imagines, I imagine anyway, to have sex with children. You've got Sean Hannity, who has his picture taken at the Bunny Ranch with professional ladies who, no offense to sex workers, that's what they do out there. And you have Newt Gingrich, who is a serial adulterer. And then of course you have the suicider. It just goes on and on and on and on and on, doesn't it? Huh? Not that there's anything wrong with any of it. If Newt Gingrich wants to have dinner with a woman who runs one of the largest porn DVD operations in the country, he should damn well be able to. It's the hypocrisy. Oh, and the fact that he's married, too. Not that anything would happen. I wonder if Newt's wife goes along when he has dinner with the porn... No, never mind. Coming up after break, I got to share this with you. You can get a preview real quick by going to Brad Friedman's website, bradblog.com. I chatted with Brad a little bit today via email, and he had up at his website something that I wasn't aware of until I went there, and we're going to talk about it when we come back. But every day there is more news that I just wonder how... The people who believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims who believe the creation myth that is the foundation of all three of those religions, you know, Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden, the talking snake, blah, blah, blah. And it all happened between 6,000 and 8,000 years ago, not a moment before that. Couldn't have, you see, because somebody calculated using the begats and the begats and the begats all the way back to Adam and Eve and realized that the earth was put together, universe, the all creation, everything was put together about 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years ago. You know, every time I start talking about this, I have this thought. After Cain slew Abel and he was banished from the Garden of Eden and he was sent to the land of Nod, which is east of Eden, according to the Bible. And the Bible says, and he knew his wife. In other words, he went over there and had sex and started having babies. But where did, I mean, is Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel? Cain murdered Abel. And then he went to the land of Nod and knew his wife. Oh, well, I digress. Anyway, archaeologists looking for signs of what the ancient climate was like in the Caucasus Mountains have come across something they weren't expecting. Signs of ancient craft work. This all tie in a second. They found fibers of wild flax that were up to 34,000 years old in the Zudzwana Cave in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. According to the New York Times science section today, some of the fibers were twisted, some were dyed, which indicates they were used for sewing clothes, weaving baskets, or making ropes. That makes these fibers the oldest known to have been used by humans, 34,000 years ago. Ofer Bar Yosef, an archaeologist with the Peabody Museum at Harvard and a lead author of a brief paper that describes the findings in science, wrote about it. He writes that most of the fibers were found in the older layers of the site dating from 24,000 years ago back earlier. Some had multiple knots. Others showed a fairly complex twisting pattern. Some showed evidence of having been cut. Among the dyed fibers were some in black, gray, and turquoise, and one in pink. Dr. Bar Yosef said the fibers clearly indicate these humans were making some kind of coats or ropes. He said there's more evidence of what is known as the Upper Paleolithic Revolution, which is a period of major technological and social change that took place tens of thousands of years ago. So when somebody who believes in the absolute inerrancy of the Bible, when they read something like this in the New York Times or wherever they read it, now I realize what your quick answer is, well, they don't read that stuff, Mike. Well, you're probably right. But when they come across it, something that, through carbon dating, which is, as far as I know, is pretty much infallible, isn't it? I mean, certain elements decay at a certain rate and you can tell how, oh, never mind. But anyway, when they discover stuff like this, laid down in sediment that is according to all science is, you know, 30,000-40,000 years old, all of a sudden they make this wondrous discovery. Oh my God, look, flax fibers woven, dyed 34,000 years ago. How do the religious people handle this
badly.
Other than badly? I mean, oh, well. I just find it also fascinating. Every time, I love reading about stuff like this. I love looking at the new pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, pictures that are right at the edge of the expanding universe. Pictures of light that left on its journey back to the Hubble 13 billion light years ago. I mean, that's astonishing stuff, and there it all is. I mean, there it is. Well, of course, it's probably fake, right? Just like our trip to the moon was fake. Just like finding woven fibers from 34,000 years ago in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia is also fake. And DNA strands and twists is just camera trickery. And, oh well. All right, stick around. When we come back, we're going to talk about what Brad has up at bradblog.com. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program. As you know, last week, Brad Friedman filled in for me. I hate to say filled in for me because he does an excellent show on his own. Maybe at some point, some radio station is going to hire him or some network. Maybe at some point he can join us here at Malloy Broadcasting on a regular basis. I don't know. But Friedman should have his own program. There's no question about it. Every time he fills in, and he is very slowly becoming like the permanent substitute host of this program. But every time he does that, he brings guests to the program or a discussion that I get emails about for days afterwards about Jesus, that Brad Friedman. Anyway, he has posted at his website some information about the interview he did with Ray McGovern, who is was with the CIA for 27 years. And, let me just share it with you. Brad writes, during my interview last night with 27-year CIA analyst Ray McGovern, the man who used to personally deliver the CIA's presidential daily briefings, the PDFs, to George Bush Sr., among other presidents, McGovern offered an extraordinarily chilling thought, particularly coming from someone with his background. In a conversation at the end of the hour, and he provides the audio and the transcript at his website, in a conversation at the end of the hour, as I was trying to pin him down for an opinion on whether or not he felt it was appropriate for CIA Director Leon Panetta to have reportedly attempted to block a lawful investigation into torture and other war crimes committed by the CIA, McGovern alluded to a book about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and noted that he felt it likely that both Leon Panetta and President Obama may have reason to fear certain elements of the CIA. He said, McGovern said, quote, let me just leave you with this thought, and that is that I think Panetta, and to a degree President Obama, are afraid. I never thought I'd hear myself saying this. I think they're afraid of the CIA, end quote. Brad continues, McGovern went on to note, quote, the stakes are very high here, end quote, in relation to Attorney General Eric Holder's recently announced investigation of the CIA, now under the direction of Leon Panetta. McGovern said, quote, his main advisors and his senior staff, Panetta's, his main advisors and his senior staff are liable for prosecution for war crimes. The war crime statute includes very severe penalties, including capital punishment for those who, if under their custody, detainees die. And we know that at least 100 have died. So this is big stakes here, end quote. Then Brad writes, he then recommended James Douglas's new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And then McGovern said, quote, he makes a very persuasive case in this book that it was President Kennedy's, the animosity that built up between him and the CIA after the Bay of Pigs and the Joint Chiefs of Staff because he was reaching out to the Russians and so forth and so on. It's a very well-researched book, and his conclusion is very alarming, end quote. Ray McGovern noted in what turned out, he said that what turned out to be a chilling end to our interview, in which he described two CIAs, Brad writes. One, McGovern says, was created by President Truman, quote, to give him the straight scoop without any fear or favor. And then its covert action arm, which really doesn't belong in this agency, end quote. McGovern referred to that CIA advisedly as the president's own personal Gestapo, which acts without oversight, but the congressional committee is once tasked to do so. McGovern says, quote, and so if you're asking why Obama and Panetta are going very, very kid glovish with the CIA, I think part of the reason or the explanation is they're afraid of these guys because these guys have a whole lot to lose if justice takes its course. So it's pretty scary. Yes, it is. End quote. Ray McGovern, 27-year CIA analyst, on Brad Friedman's program last week, the Mike Malloy Show, but the program. Well, it was Brad Friedman. When he's hosting, is his program, I guess. But you know, the Kennedy, I haven't read this book, and I guess I'm going to need to do that. JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, written by James W. Douglas. We've talked about this for how many years? Huh? I know you have with your friends, I certainly have with mine, that to give even a moment's credibility to the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald, acting on his own, killed JFK and wounded that he wounded the governor and murdered Kennedy. And then in turn, wasn't it convenient when Jack Ruby killed him? And then wasn't it convenient when Jack Ruby died of cancer? And wasn't convenient, and on and on and on. I don't want to stir up that nest again, but if you have ever followed the trail of dead people that had any information whatsoever regarding what occurred on November 22nd, 1963, you know beyond any doubt, just like the people who have been pushing and pushing and pushing for the truth on 9/11. And have been marginalized and called idiots and jerks and conspiracy theorists and morons and nutcases and, oh, just leave it alone and yada, yada, yada. You know, been there, done that. Only it was called the Kennedy assassination. So here we are again. And we've talked about this on the program. What is the hesitancy on the part of the Obama administration? And I'm going to have to agree with Ray McGovern that, it's very probable that Panetta and all heads of the CIA are political appointees, all DCIAs, as they call them, the director. They're all, these are not career CIA people. They're not career spooks. It's a political appointment. So when Leon Panetta was appointed, I'm sure that the career officers whose lives, very lives, may be hanging in the balance as to the outcome of these investigations. I'm sure they sat down with Leon and said, okay, let us explain some things to you here. And whatever the explanations were, I'm sure enough was left unsaid to convince Leon Panetta that there was a line up to which this investigation could go, but across which it dare not proceed. Is that conspiracy theorist nonsense? Huh? Is that tinfoil hat stuff? No, it is not. Not to me, and probably not to you. I've said it a million times. There are two major events that occurred in my lifetime. The assassination of JFK and the events of 9/11, 2001, that I will go to my grave because I know that the truth will not out by the time I step off this earthly coil. But I will go to my grave knowing that both stories are goddamn lies, absolutely top to bottom, complete fabrications, completely. And I think anyone who has even the slightest familiarity with analytical thinking or common sense would have to come to the same conclusions. So, interesting stuff. So read what's Brad's website, bradblog.com. It's all there. And there's one other thing that I want to share with you when we come back. I've been very hesitant to do this. Very, very, very hesitant to bring this up. But I think I'm going to do it. As you know, Max Blumenthal has a book out called Republican Gomorrah. And he was interviewed on Democracy Now! Several weeks back. And Jude, who sent this to me, said that she listened to the interview and she said it was unnerving beyond words. I want to quote something to you, maybe two pages, page and a half, from Max Blumenthal's book, Republican Gomorrah, when we come back. And you can draw your own conclusions.
Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Okay. I've gotten a spate of emails here that not every CIA appointee was the head of the CIA was a political appointee. In fact, there was one who was a career CIA and then became the head of the CIA, and that would be George Herbert Walker Bush. Okay. All right. Just, you know, Prescott Bush's boy. I will share this thing with you from Republican Gomorrah when we come back after the break. But I have an email from Prairie 2 here, one of our missives from our economic affairs correspondent, Bruce Enberg. So let me do that real quick. He writes, retail sales jumped 2.7% in August, 2.7% in August. Yeah, I heard about that today, and Susan Lasovich, who is definitely a friend. I used to work with her at CNN, and she's now one of the business reporters on CNN. And she was on the morning show, you know, after 9 o'clock, talking about this new report. And, well, maybe there's light at the end of the tunnel, but I digress. Retail sales jumped 2.7% in August, but two-thirds of that was from cash from clunkers. And when you exclude gas station sales, the increase was only 0.6%. This increase was mostly from pent-up demand for clothing, electronics, and general merchandise, with furniture and hardware down sharply. Sales continue to be down more than 5% from a year ago, and retail stock prices are down on a gloomy sales forecast. Wholesale prices took a big and unexpected jump last month. The standard line from the media is that, quote, this is fueling fears of inflation, end quote. In reality, it reflects the collapsing dollar, as imports are climbing in price even faster than the currency trade indicates. Many companies don't want to be paid in dollars and are apparently raising prices to get ahead of the inevitable collapse. More Americans are below the poverty line now at 16% of the population. In total wealth, the U.S. now lags behind Europe as the wealthiest region in the world, but we are still well ahead of Africa for now. Of course, most of our wealth is just on paper. Europe was largely a smoking ruin 60 years ago, and the U.S. had most of the world's manufacturing capacity and all the money. Now we import $4.50 in manufactured goods for every dollar we export, and even that dollar is heavily loaded with so-called value-added agricultural products like pig intestines that the Chinese use to make pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, and so forth. The rest of our exports are made up of raw materials and crops, much as any third world country. We used to export debt, but I doubt anybody's really buying any of that anymore, but rather it is a sort of shell game managed by the Fed to keep Armageddon at bay. China is threatening to retaliate for Obama's tariffs on steel pipe and tires by raising the tariff on chickens coming from the United States. Traditionally, you raise the tariff on a similar product, but that's not possible for China since we don't make anything. To get the attention of one of your third world trading partners, you raise the tariff on bananas or chickens. Prairie2.com. Yeah, I heard that also, and I thought, yeah, that is kind of strange. Raising the tariff on chickens? Jesus, God. You know, as Prairie 2 doesn't say anymore, lay in a supply of canned goods. I wonder why. You know, I took him seriously, and I did. And probably should be flash frozen stuff, but on the assumption that, or freeze dried, I should say, dried stuff. But then I think about, well, where do you get the water, you know, to reanimate it, so to speak. So we're just going with the canned stuff, and it's getting pretty big. Jesus, God, I don't like to talk about this. I really don't. You know, I've got a 5-year-old. What am I going to say, Molly? Come here. It's time to open a can so we can have dinner. We live in strange times, don't we? I also have a, what are we calling K's reports, our educational affairs correspondent? Report card. We have a report card from Kay a little bit later in the program tonight. So, but when we come back, I want to share this. This is really scary stuff from Max Blumenthal's new book, relatively to Republican Gomorrah. I mean, it is, that's why I hesitated to read this, but the person who sent it to me said, well, you know, if you need to wait, okay. You know, when in doubt, yeah, hesitate. But I don't think so. I think I want to do this when we come back. So make sure your doors and windows are locked and all the lights are on. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Molloy.
Nobody give me trouble.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. By the way, regarding the Kennedy murder, go to tvnewslies.org, go to their site, and then go to the donation section, and then search for Kennedy. And they have a video, The Men Who Killed Kennedy. It was on the History Channel. And for a small donation, you can get that free, The Men Who Killed Kennedy. TVNewsLies, is it .com or .org? Oh, it doesn't make any difference. TVNewsLies.com, .org. When you get to the site, go to the donation section, then search for Kennedy, and you'll find this video. All right. Max Blumenthal has a new book out called Republican Gomorrah. I am right in the process now of reading, what's his name? Is it Frank Charlotte's book, The Family, which is disturbing enough. But, and next on the line is Chris Hedges' book. I've got that on the nightstand next to my bed about, the fascist takeover of the country. So, I will get to Republican Gomorrah. But, I want to share this with you. Jude sent it to me. This is from pages 120 and 122 in the book. All right. And Blumenthal writes the following. In his 1973 book, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, Fromm, I guess that's Eric Fromm, analyzed the phenomenon of necrophilia, concluding that it extended beyond the traditional concept of erotic attraction to rotting flesh and also manifested itself in, quote, malignant aggression, unalloyed from sex, in acts of the pure passion to destroy, end quote. The necrophilous character, Fromm wrote, is passionately attracted, quote, to all that is dead, decayed, and putrid, sickly. It is the passion to tear apart living structures, end quote. Together with his research partner, Michael McCobley, Fromm surveyed a diverse group of research subjects for necrophilous anti-life tendencies. Across the board, Fromm detected a profound link between necrophilous character traits and the right-wing ideology. Fromm wrote, quote, the study asked the respondents a number of questions that permitted correlating their political opinions to their character. In all of the samples, we found that anti-life tendencies were significantly correlated to political positions that supported increased military power and favored repression against dissenters, end quote. Fromm identified necrophilous characters as among the most dangerous members of any society. He wrote, quote, they are the haters, the racists, those in favor of war, bloodshed, and destruction. They are dangerous not only if they are political leaders, but also as the potential cohorts for a dictatorial leader. They become the executioners, the terrorists, the torturers. Without them, no terror system would be set up. But the less intense necrophiles are also politically important. While they may not be among its first adherents, they are necessary for the existence of a terror regime because they form a solid basis, although not necessarily a majority, for it to gain power. End quote. Blumenthal goes on. The link that Fromm detected between necrophilous destructiveness and radical right-wing ideology was particularly pronounced at the conclusion of the so-called Judicial War on Faith Conference recently, when participants launched spontaneously into imprecatory prayer, a disturbing ritual in which worshipers call upon God to murder the satanic enemy. A pastor asked all the men in the room to get down on the floor and pray. With no other choice, I moved my plastic upholstered chair aside, took to my hands and knees, and listened as plaintive voices rose all around me with vengeful maledictions against judicial evildoers. One preacher piped up, Father, we echo the words of the Apostle Paul because we know Judge Greer claims to be a Christian. So as the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of our Lord Jesus. As the conference attendees filed out of the banquet hall and into the humid, rain-flecked night, mostly silent except for the few who were still sobbing, they seemed prepared to do anything, absolutely anything, against judges. "I want to impale them," Michael Schwartz told me. Now, Michael Schwartz, that's the end of the quote from Max Blumenthal's book. Michael Schwartz is the founder of the Washington, D.C. chapter of Operation Rescue. And Michael Schwartz had become the chief of staff to Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn. And you've seen his name in the news recently, haven't you? You know, everything that I've been reading lately, and I'm sure going to get Republican Gomorrah, this thing, is it Eric Fromm that is being quoted here? I think it is. But this psychosis, malignant aggression, the phenomenon of necrophilia. It's a passion to tear apart living structures. It doesn't have to be the standard definition, which is pretty gruesome and vile to begin with. I took a course in abnormal psychology 1,000 years ago, and necrophilia was sex with a corpse. That's all I remember. Maybe when I was reading the text, I got that far and said, okay, I think I'll go study flowers now. But when I read this, just this little excerpt that Jude sent me, all of a sudden a lot of things became clear about, we've talked before about this madness that is fundamental Christianity. I mean, absolute madness, insanity. That it itself is a cannibalistic cult. It's a blood cult. And as far as eating the flesh and drinking the blood of somebody in order to expiate your sins, I mean, what is that? That's not. And people wonder why I shelter my children when they were kids and my 5-year-old from any of this nonsense. Only it's not nonsense. It is horrifying stuff, just horrifying. But all of a sudden, we have a political class in this country that is in power and is ascendant. I believe what you want, but it is ascendant. When you have a society where only 47% of the people, what's the numbers? 47% either believe or don't believe. It's almost half of the people in this country do not believe in science. They just reject it out of hand. And the Christianity, this is not the Christianity I grew up with. The Christianity I grew up with was kind of peaceful. I mean, the mythologies were the same. The stories were the same. The superstitions were the same. I can remember my grandmother telling me, if I didn't live a Christ-like life, I would burn in hell. Now, when you tell that to a 6 or 7-year-old, you get one of two reactions. Either like, ah, and it scars them for life, or a complete rejection. Thank God I fell into the latter group. Like, come on, Granny, are you out of your mind? Come on, you're my grandma. Let's go can some peaches. You know, don't tell me this stuff that, you know. But Other than that crazy fundamentalist Christian stuff that my grandmother, bless her heart, was into, the stories she told me about Christianity were peaceful, loving, kind. The parables, the 2 or 3 sermons that Jesus preached, and so on and so forth. And I went to vacation Bible school, and they never talked about, you're going to burn in hell! You know, it was more like, be a good kid and do unto others and don't curse, smoke, or, drink whiskey. Don't take the Lord's name in vain, yada, yada, yada. And taking the Lord's name in vain has nothing to do with saying the word goddamn. I mean, that's not taking the Lord's name in vain. If you understand your Bible or understand this stuff, it is not. But anyway, the madness that has happened, the craziness. Margaret Atwood has a new book out that I'm going to get. You know, the woman who wrote The Handmaid's Tale? I just read a review of it in today's New York Times, and it sounds like something I want to get my hands on. But This kind of crazy Christianity and crazy right-wing political stuff, it is insane. It's insane. And then when you couple that with the crazy fundamentalism of Islam and the stuff that's going on in those countries, and mix it together, there is a perfect recipe here for, oh boy. So I would imagine that there is some fear in certain circles of political, religious governance in this country about the Pakistanis having a nuclear bomb or 6 or 12. Too much weirdness. When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro, right?
Microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. We'll do Kay Petrini's report card. She is our education affairs correspondent during the next hour. In tomorrow's Washington Post, the article is many employers to raise the cost of health benefits, according to a survey. This is employer provided health insurance. I wonder what the teabag crazy people think about this. The Washington Post says, as businesses contend with rising costs, many workers face an erosion of health benefits next year. That's according to an annual survey released Tuesday, today, by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Health Research and Educational Trust. 40% of employers surveyed said they are likely to increase the amount their workers pay out of pocket for doctor visits. Almost as many, 40%, said they are likely to raise annual deductibles and the amount workers pay for prescription drugs. 9% said they plan to tighten eligibility for health benefits. 8% said they plan to drop coverage altogether. 41% of employers said they were somewhat or very likely to increase the amount employees pay in premiums. Authors of the study said the findings underscore the need for federal action to rein in costs. That's right. This is why the public option, Truth Seekers, is so important. And this is why the insurance, the health insurance industry is using its whores, no offense to sex workers, the real sex workers. It's using its whores, like members of Congress, the suicider, Glenn Beck, the drug addict, Rush Limbaugh, the Bunny Ranch visitor, Sean Hannity, to protect them. Talking about death panels, and they're going to kill Down syndrome babies and your old granny. And, oh, the newest? The death panels are going to be staffed by illegal immigrants. Why not? One of Obama's biggest challenges as he struggles to overhaul the nation's healthcare system, according to the Post, has been winning over Americans who are satisfied with their existing coverage. Well, guess what? A major business lobby weighed in today saying that if current trends continue, annual health care costs for employers will rise 166% over the next decade to about $29,000 per employee. The chief executive of Eastman Kodak, And a leader of the Business Roundtable said, quote, maintaining the status quo is simply not an option. These costs are unsustainable and would put millions of workers at risk, end quote. And as the Post says, rather than letting the trends go unchecked, employers are likely to adopt a variety of cost-saving measures. Those steps could include giving employees financial incentives to participate in weight loss programs, order prescription drugs by mail, undergo health assessments. In addition, before workers pursue costly procedures such as back surgery, they could be required to receive briefings that explain the potential downside of the treatment. Oh my goodness, this sounds like gatekeepers. This sounds like rationed health care. God damn, but it's not coming from the government, you morons. Why doesn't anybody in the why does anybody in the teabagger brigade pick up a copy of the Washington Post and read this? Do you not understand, you right-wingers who listen to the program? Don't you get it? Don't you understand what's being said here? And this is coming from the Business Roundtable. This is coming from corporate America. You are screwed, you dumbasses, unless you support Obama's public option. You know, the one where they'll bring Granny in front of the firing squad, you halfwits. Sorry, lost my temper. The Post goes on, almost two-thirds of corporations surveyed by the firm conducting this survey plan to call on employees to pay a greater share of health plan costs next year. Next year. So, here's what's going to happen, you halfwits, you racist bastards who are doing the bidding of the real Nazis in this country, the Glenn Becks and the Limbaughs and the rest of these thugs. Here's what's going to happen. Not only are you going to have rationed health care if the Obama administration and the Democrats don't put something together, not only is it going to be rationed health care, but it's going to cost you more than you'll be able to afford. And guess what, booby? Either your employer will drop you altogether, then what will you do? Or your premiums will be jacked up so high that you'll have to take yourself off the plan, you dumbasses. And then what are you going to do? At that point, you will go sit in a corner and you'll put your thumb in your mouth and you'll say, why did I listen to the suicider Glenn Beck? Oh, damn. Why did I go to that thing in Washington? Why didn't I work my ass off to get a public option? Ah, but you didn't, because, you know, public options, that's communism, or wait a minute, Nazism, or wait a minute, socialism, no, wait a second, wait a minute. Oh, it's Obamaism, no, wait a minute, it's Obamacare, no, what is it? It's something-ism. I know, because Glenn Beck told me it was, and Rush Hannity and Limbaugh, George and Sean Beck, and they told me, they all told me, oh my God, what? I have a cancer on my testicle and I don't have insurance. Oh, but I had insurance. Oh, I wish I had a public option. A tumor on my testicle. Oh my God. What does that mean? Is it, are you going to have to cut everything off? Oh no. I mean, I don't have the money for you to cut it off. Well, what am I going to do? 3 of the Malloy program tonight. We're going to be taking your phone calls here momentarily. Regarding that little bit from, what was it, Republican Gomorrah? Was that the book? Or was it conservative? Republican Gomorrah, Max Blumenthal's book. Sheila, who lives out in the country in Oklahoma, wrote, Mike, bear in mind that I'm alone out here on the creek bank. It is nearing the witching hour, and I hear coyotes yelping out there in the dark. Please, just read the pet goat. Sheila did not want me to read that bit about Republican Gomorrah and the necrophilious freaks that are now running that party. Oh, my God. It's just getting weirder and weirder. I swear to God. And quoting Hunter Thompson does not help. It's just madness. But it is time to hear from Kay Petrini, our educational affairs correspondent. Another one of Kay's report cards.
Teach your children well, 'cause their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they fix.
Hi, Mike. Something you said last night really caught my attention. You were talking about the inability of many religions, religious people, to accept science. You said, paraphrasing, that religion is cast in fire and brimstone. It is immutable and permanent. You pointed out that this is in direct opposition to science, which says, this is the way it looks now, but we're going to continue to probe and challenge and push and investigate. If we find that there is a variation or a deviance, then we will incorporate that. Or explore and see where it goes. If it knocks down the previous thought structure, we'll knock it down. You finish by saying, you see, that's what's so threatening about science. It requires one to accept and challenge at the same time. I went back and listened to that segment again, yet another benefit of being a podcast subscriber, and was struck by how your observations carry over into my field, social science. On the first day of my U.S. history classes each year, I explained to students that in this class, the so-called stone tablets view of history is out the window. My colleagues and I use an approach called historiography, which is very much like science in that it takes what we have traditionally been taught about history and challenges it. Many on the right malign this as revisionism. Well, yeah, what are we supposed to do when we learn new information? Ignore it? One of the students' first assignments is to examine three different historical sources on the subject of Christopher Columbus. When students get to my class, most of them know the Columbus mythology. They know the names of Columbus's ships, and everyone knows that we have a school holiday named for Columbus. I hand out two documents that students read in class. One, an excerpt from the Journal of Columbus's First Voyage, and two, a passage from James Loewen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, which discusses in detail the atrocities that are usually left out of American history textbooks. In their notebooks, students then make a three-column chart, comparing and contrasting the information from each source. For homework, they read a chapter of their textbook dealing with Columbus, and then finish up their three-column charts by comparing and contrasting what was included or left out in that account. I think it's part of human nature to view historical figures as either heroes or villains, but I try to overcome that in my classes. After this exercise, most students are able to see that such oversimplifications do not provide an accurate account of history. My goal is to make students aware of a theme that runs through American history from the get-go, contradiction and paradox. We come back to this time and again during the school year. For example, how could Thomas Jefferson have written about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness while owning slaves? How could a nation that claims to be founded on freedom allow Jim Crow laws to flourish? Later this year, I'm sure we'll also be asking, how can people who claim to believe that all men are created equal walk around with signs calling the President of the United States a lion African? Unfortunately, I believe that many teachers, students, and parents approach the subject of American history the same way they do science, from a perspective of fear. They want to keep it simple. They don't want to address anything that could put a blemish on the mythological narrative that is presented in most American history textbooks. Tragically, by taking this tack, they perpetuate the kind of ignorance that makes it possible for so many Americans to assert that racism is all in the past, even as they carry placards with hateful caricatures of President Obama and slogans like, "We came unarmed this time." After that ugly display in Washington last Saturday, it looks like I may need to do some historiography on the concept of civil rights progress in this country. K.
Teach your children well, 'cause their fathers hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they fix.
You know, it must be very difficult being a school teacher right now, especially an American history school teacher. It must be extremely, extremely difficult. All right, the phone number here is 877-996-2556. If you'd like to weigh in tonight with a comment, we invite you to call 877-996-2556. From the Fort Worth Telegram in Texas, the Star Telegram, a retired Air National Guard general called in last Thursday with three big worries. Brigadier General Tom Daniels of Fort Worth, retired, said, quote, something bad's gone wrong with this country. Something's wrong in Arlington, something's wrong in Austin, and something's wrong in America, end quote. He flew missions in Vietnam and the Pentagon. He served proudly under President George Herbert Walker Bush, quote, whom I love, end quote, he added. Now our country chooses a black man as president, and suddenly the governor is talking about secession. And Arlington, Texas is boycotting the president. They won't even let children see him in school. 8 years removed from 9/11, General Daniels feels a chill. Look how united we were, he said in his booming command voice. Look. Look how we've squandered it. He didn't even have to mention Representative Joe Wilson. We're hollering at each other now, Daniel said. We hate each other. And he sees that as dividing our heroes in uniform. He said, quote, I talked to military guys all over the world, white, brown, black. They're asking if it was unpatriotic to talk this way about the last president. Isn't this unpatriotic? They're concerned. This is nothing but open, unabated racism. Nobody's saying that. End quote. I know what some of you are going to say. It's political, not racial. But I also can't imagine people acting this way over, say, a President Harry Reid or even President Al Gore. General Daniels says, quote, all I know is the black guy wins and suddenly these nuts are out there on television and radio preaching to long-haul truck drivers all over the country. Somebody needs to start talking back. Where are the moderates in the Republican Party? Where are the people like George Herbert Walker Bush who made sense? They're letting the nuts lead them around by the nose. End quote. He is particularly steamed that Arlington, Texas schools still refuse to replay Obama's address to school children, yet will bus fifth graders to hear George W. Bush on September 21st at a Super Bowl event at Cowboys Stadium. Daniels reserves special vitriol for Texas Governor Rick Perry. Daniels said, he's Air Force. He should be ashamed. I'm ashamed of him. He should know better than to float talk about Texas leaving the U.S. He had one final question. When is somebody in Arlington, Texas, or Austin going to stand up to these people? We'll be right back.
The Hindenburg was a giant Zeppelin. Its makers made a minor oversight. Before they filled it up with explosive gas, they should have fixed the no-smoking light. History is made by stupid people. Clever people wouldn't even try. If you want a place in the history books, then do something dumb before you die.
the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. This is the Malloy Show. And Ken is in Houston, Texas, listening on XM. Hey, Ken.
Oh, hey, guy. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Oh, fine. You know, I've been listening to you for, my gosh, a number of years. Yeah, and I'm going to ask you a question. It's not meant to be rude, so please forgive the wording on it. But your respect for the concepts of Christianity is so found, you know, it's just an amazing point. And I listen to people who really get down on every aspect of it, but you have such a great respect for the purity of the truth, and I've wanted to compliment you on that, and also intrigues me. I told the person that answered, I guess it's Kathy, that you remind me of Paul in a certain way, that before... I mean, he was so against the concept that when they stoned Stephen at the gates, that he was one of the leading advocates of death to Christians and then became one of the greatest proponents. I often wonder if you're not in that kind of a transition.
No. Any transition that may have occurred in my life, Ken, occurred decades ago. I'm the most anti-religious person you would ever come across through the radio or in person. I see organized religion as one of the reasons that human beings are hell-bent on destroying not only each other, but the planet, and if they could, the whole damn universe. I detest religion. I don't find anything humorous or insightful about religion. There are some religious avatars who I think had messages that should have resonated with people. I think the Prophet Muhammad had some things to say. I think the Buddha had some things to say. I think Jesus had some things to say. I mean, some of these people who, around whom these religions were founded after they died, I think they had some important things to say. But religion to me sucks. It's the worst possible thing that human beings could ever have invented. And it comes out of, fear of death, hatred of the other, disrespect for life, which seems to be a paradox. It's total disrespect for life, but it's complete fear of death. It's difficult to process that. But to me, religion, any religion, all religion, it will eat your brain. It will eat your brain alive. Now, you know, a lot of people say, well, you always make exceptions for Wicca. To me, Wicca is not really, it's not an organized religion. If people want to, it's earth-based to begin with. I don't think Wicca promises eternal life if you just do this or just don't do that. So I guess like every sweeping statement, there are some exceptions that can be found. But as far as the three that disgust me the most are the three religions, the people of the book, you know, the three religions that are based on Old Testament mythologies and superstitions and histories and so on and so forth. As a history of a people, I'm fine. Don't misunderstand. Insofar as the so-called Old Testament was a guidebook for Jews, great. But once it became a tract that the Christians used to enforce by force their belief system, then to me, it's like Islam that says is okay. And I know I'm going to get emails from Muslims who are going to say you're crazy, you're in hell, Mike. We don't say that. But Islam that treats women like piglets, you know, 12-year-old girls dying in childbirth because they were given in marriage, you know. And I know somebody's going to say, well, that's not Islam, Mike. That's traditions in Arabic communities. And to that I say horse snot. I don't like religion, Ken, at all. I detest it. But thanks a lot for checking in. I appreciate it. It is a vile system used to control people, scare people, and make people go kill. That's all it is. And I don't challenge anyone to challenge that. I mean, you know, you believe what you believe. I've said a million times what John Lennon said, whatever gets you through the night, go for it. But to me, religion is poison, just absolute, corrosive, destructive poison. And I hate it. I really do. So, I'm in no transition period. My transitions happened a long time ago, after very careful considerations and studies and listening and thinking and observing and looking at history, religious and non-religious, and how religions have played such a mind-bogglingly destructive role in the history of the human species. I mean, just unbelievable destruction. And so I say, religion, screw it. About 25 before the hour. Nan is in St. Louis listening on XM. Hey, Nan.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, I'm glad you're back. I missed you.
Yeah.
Nobody quite characterizes the right like you do. I was going to withdraw. Hey, I have a, since you are the paragon of knowledge of all things left of left, my dad and I have had this constant dialogue our entire lives about religion, and there's this little verse. And we feel exactly the way you do. It's not that we don't have a difference in that. But I said I thought that you would know the author, so don't let me down.
Oh, God. All right.
Okay. It is very simple. Good people do good things. Bad people do bad things. For good people to do bad things, it takes religion.
You know, I just saw that quote within the past 2 or 3 months, and
you did, and you don't know who it is.
Voltaire. I think it was an historical philosopher. I'm sure that Reg will email me the answer to that, or Prairie Two will, or maybe Irish Dave.
Okay, good, because I don't have a computer.
Okay, well,
so I can't look it up.
As soon as, or Kate in the desert may do it. Somebody will send me the author of that. Say it again.
Good people do good things. Bad people do bad things. For good people to do bad things, it takes religion.
Yeah.
And I have one more question for you.
Okay.
Okay. My dad and I's argument all these years has been he thinks that when you're totally by yourself in the quiet of night with just your beliefs, that nobody really believes in religion. And I think they do.
Well, I would agree with you. I think that's when, you know, the Pharisees made a big deal about the public display of their religion. And the people who the meditative believers, the ones who, I think Jesus said, if you, you know, if you want to pray to my Father, go into your closet. Don't do it in private. And I think true believers, believe even more so when, more sincerely, let me put it that way, when they are alone in the dark of night out in the desert someplace. Yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, I do too. But he's just convinced that no one could possibly believe.
Well, he may be thinking about the Pharisees, about the ones that made a big show, at least in the Jewish faith, the ones that made a big show about their religious belief. But
well, he just thinks any thinking human being can't possibly believe that.
Okay, here I've got the answer for you, Steven Weinberg. That's where that quote comes from. Here's what it says: with or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion.
Okay, who was it?
A guy named Steven, S-T-E-V-E-N, Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, Steven Weinberg.
Okay, and did you say the woman that the book you recommend was Margaret Atwood?
Yeah, she has a new book out, and the title of it has completely slipped my mind.
Okay, but if that's her name, I can find it. It's her latest book, right?
Yeah, yeah. She's the one that wrote the Handmaid's Tale.
Okay.
If you get a chance, I know that's I'm going to have to put on my reading list. I'm so far behind. I'll never get. Oops! Don't drop the microphone. I'll never get through. But that's one I think it's fiction. You know, Margaret Atwood writes fiction. So.
Okay. Great.
All right,
great.
Thanks, Nan.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
All right, take care. I appreciate it. Yes, Miss Kathy?
Well, the reason I agree with Nan as opposed to her dad about religion, frankly, is because people out there in the desert, whether they're alone in the desert or alone in their bedrooms or alone anywhere in the dark of night, are afraid. And I think that to be a true believer requires a lot of fear, because you feel like you need some sort of great protector, and there's something comforting.
Well,
I remember having arguments with my mother about my, what she called my decision to be an atheist, and she is not. She's not like a Bible-thumping churchgoer, but she believes in some version of God. And she said, oh, you just think you're just so smart. And you just think it's just so, so clever. And you're just, you know, like I was putting on airs or something.
Right.
And I said, you know, actually the opposite is true. I wish I had that willingness to suspend disbelief. I really do. I wish I had some sort of ability to step off into the fantasy island that I believe you have to have to believe in you know,
I disagree. I know you well enough to, I don't think you wish you believed that.
There's something comforting letting God, Jesus will out, you know, it's God's will. I mean, you can just throw your hands up at any horrible thing that happens and say, God has a plan. We cannot know the mind of God, instead of trying to figure out some rational reason or just accept that there's evil in the world.
Maybe you're just looking for a perfect father.
Yeah, whatever.
I don't know. I've what the caller from Texas said, you know, am I like Saul on the road to Damascus, who has his epiphanous moment? Hell no. Whatever epiphanous moment I ever had, and I think most people who were brought up in a religious belief system like I was, and then figure out that it's madness, I don't think there's any epiphanous moment. I've quoted or I've mentioned Elie Wiesel, his book Night, where his epiphanous moment came when he was 8 or 9 years old and was taken into Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen to be murdered because he was Jewish. And one of the things he saw, you know, he's a kid, 8 or 9 years old. He saw an open pit where the corpses of children like him were being burned in the night, and hence the title. And he said in the book, I'm paraphrasing, but the sound, the smell, the sight, in that moment, as a 9-year old who had been brought up in the Jewish tradition, the Orthodox Jewish tradition, in that moment, he fully and completely understood that any talk of God was nothing more than insane mythologizing, wishful thinking. Now, I'm sure that Elie Wiesel has not let the thoughts of a 9-year-old dictate his entire life where it concerns religion. But I don't know. Maybe he is an agnostic or an atheistic Jew, of which there are many. Many people claim that title, Judaism being not just a religion, but also a cultural approach to existence. So, I think that was a part of my epiphany, if to use the caller's description of Saul on the road to Damascus, had to do with reading about Treblinka, reading about Auschwitz, reading about death marches and the Crusades and the invasion of the Western Hemisphere by crazed religious fanatics. So, you know, yeah.
But do you agree also that it's just a way for people to deal with their fear? They have no other comfort out there in the night.
The first savior was the first recorded savior. Wasn't it Beowulf or was it somebody before him? In mythology, you know, defending the village against the demon Grendel. And that was the first, from that myth, doesn't that precede Christianity's myths by, I don't know, you know. There's always been that fear of the darkness. The ultimate fear of the darkness, of course, is the fear of the grave. And if there's a way out of that, give it to me. You know, has always been. I don't think anybody necessarily is totally without anxiety about death, but I think that anxiety comes from the inability of the ego to contemplate its own non-existence. I mean, you can't do that. You can imagine anybody dead except yourself, right? You can't do it. Because the ego is incapable of doing that.
But speaking of Obama's health care plan.
Right. Steven Weinberg, a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And I might as well add this. His logic has been taken up by many of the neo-atheists, but fellow physicist Freeman Dyson added this most elegant gloss. Weinberg's statement is true as far as it goes, but it is not the whole truth. To make it the whole truth, we must add an additional clause. And for bad people to do good things, that takes religion. The main point of Christianity is that it is a religion for sinners. Jesus made that very clear. When the Pharisees asked his disciples, "Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners?" He said, "I come to call not the righteous, but sinners to repentance." Only a small fraction of sinners repent and do good things, but only a small fraction of good people are led by the religion to do bad things. So in the spirit of oppositional viewpoints, there you go.
This far from heaven, this far from heaven and stars, stars.
Thanks to our correspondents tonight, Sharon Gordy, Bruce Enberg, Kay Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, and our technical advisor, Ben Birch, programs engineers, Kathy Bay, and she is also the executive producer. Paul is in Canton, Georgia, listening online. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Okay. I was telling Kathy, I said, there's one real positive about the Saturday teabagger event.
Yeah.
With all the radio time they get and TV time and all the stations are on, they managed to get, what, 50 to, if we're real generous, 100,000 people to show up. That's
right.
Utter failure with 300 million people in this country.
Well, I would think the estimates now that I've heard are anywhere from 60 to 75,000. What I like is the picture that was making the rounds on the web that was taken a decade ago that the teabaggers claimed was a picture of their event on Saturday, an event that was actually the Promise Keepers. Remember them?
Right.
From back in 95, 6, 7, somewhere back there. And there were, in fact, maybe 1.5 million people that showed up for that. So, you know, what I've said before, I stand by. Right-wingers, Republicans, the teabaggers, the rest of these people are liars.
Right.
That is their essential nature. They are liars.
And the other part I don't get is why we don't do a little bit more on our side. Why aren't the more left-leaning members of Congress acting like the blue dog Democrats and saying, if you don't have our stuff in the bill, we're not going to vote for your bill?
Because I think the Democratic Party has become nothing but another corporate-owned party. It's just not as strident and as psychotic yet as the Republican Party. I don't have a whole lot of faith anymore. And I hate to say that, Paul, because I've been a Democrat since I've been anything. I've always believed in the Democratic Party. I believed in what they've done. Historically speaking, in this country, at least in the past 75 years, it was only the Democratic Party that kept the country together and provided social progress. But these Democrats in Congress now, starting with Nancy Pelosi, you know, you have a president who has committed war crimes and impeachable offenses, and she says, well, impeachment's off the table, we're not going to do anything.
Exactly.
That to me says, okay, that's it. You know, I'll still call myself a Democrat, but it's going to be very difficult for me to vote Democratic from here on out. I just don't know how in the hell I'm going to do it. I really don't. But that's just my personal trip, you know.
But I also think a little bit, and some of those people might be what McGovern was talking about when, what was his name that hosted for you, Brad hosted for you. He said a lot of these people are worried that the CIA is going to come after them and maybe kill them.
Yeah, that's what we talked about early this evening. You may have missed the first hour.
Yeah,
I went to Brad's website today, bradblog.com, and read this and went, holy Christ.
Yeah.
Because, you know, McGovern, Ray McGovern, is not, you know, some fantasist. I mean, 27 years he was in the CIA. He used to deliver PDFs to Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
I mean, this guy knows what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah.
So, I don't think you and I and millions of other people have any doubt at all that there is an element of the CIA. The CIA is a terrorist organization to begin with, but there's an element within the CIA that is just beyond the pale that nobody can control.
Mm-hmm. That's what the black programs are there for.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, have a good night.
All right. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Yeah, you know, I go back to the Kennedy assassination, Operation Northwoods. Did you do your research last night? Did you do your homework? Did you go to Google or whatever search engine you use and type in Operation Northwoods? It was 9/11/2001. There it is. Only it happened to be in 1962. Shortly after the Cuban Revolution, when it became clear that Fidel Castro was not an agrarian reformer, he was in fact a communist. And the plan that was Operation Northwoods was exactly what happened on September 11, 2001. Exactly. It's right there. But we're to believe that 2001 was just incompetence on the part of the Bush administration, right. Victor is in St. Paul listening on AM 950. Hey, Victor.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right.
Oh, man, maybe you can help Mike. Maybe you can help me qualify this statement. They accuse Barack of being a Nazi and loving socialism. Now, if I understand this correctly, the Nazi Party, they started with propaganda and vicious lies and rumors. And how can they call Barack a Nazi? Because it is them that are more akin to the Nazi Party.
Right. Well, but that's true. But Victor, you know the answer. They're doing this because these are fools. These are ignorant fools. These are willfully ignorant fools who allow themselves to have their brains sucked out by people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and the rest of these thugs. Their brains are sucked out, and in place of their brains is put this propaganda nonsense. They will call Obama a communist in the same breath that they call him a Nazi. And which, I mean, what other proof does anybody need? These fools don't know what they're talking about. In the first place, they can't even keep the term. You couldn't get them to define the term Nazism, or define the term communism. It would be impossible. They'd have to tune on Lou Dobbs on CNN or Glenn Beck on Fox to get an answer. These are morons, Victor. You know that. These are absolute morons.
But you know what makes them dangerous, though?
Well, yeah, they're morons.
Yeah, throughout our history, throughout the history of the world, actually, the people that carry the biggest mouth are the ones that usually can sway the general public. And I'm afraid that the liberal station, they're basically outnumbered 2-1. I'm afraid it's going to be a tough road for us to hold if we can't figure out a way to quell some of that noise that they're talking about on the other side there.
I hear you. Victor, I got to go, man. That's the theme music. Thanks, Victor. I appreciate you checking in. Take care.
They're also scary because they have guns.
I'll see you tomorrow night. Well, so do we. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.